Today on Against the Grain. It's an open secret that there's an affinity between members of law enforcement and the far right. White supremacist and fascist groups count police in their ranks, and many in law enforcement, from the federal down to the local level, turn a blind eye to the activities of the far right, while targeting anti-fascist and other left activists. Michael German discusses the relationship between the police and the far right. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. From 2017 to 2022 alone, far-right militants killed at least 175 people in this country. Yet such white supremacist and fascist violence is not tracked by the FBI. Instead, it focuses its efforts on environmentalists, anti-fascists, and the movement for Black Lives. Michael German is a former FBI agent who writes about the affinity between the far right and law enforcement in his new book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. He worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups and is now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. He's also the author of Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Our Democracy. Michael, in recent years, we've seen strikingly overt street violence from the far right, as well as clashes with those who would oppose them. How have the police treated those two broad groups, the extreme right and left-wing protesters and anti-fascists, sometimes called Antifa or Antifa?
The police treat them very differently, which is quite frustrating because there's a very clear and long record of white supremacists and far-right militants being engaged in very serious violence on a regular basis that leaves many people dead. And the people who often came out during the first Trump administration from their communities to protest the growing public presence of these far-right groups would end up getting mistreated by the police, often kettled, maced, beaten, arrested in mass arrests, while these far-right militants, which typically were coming from out of town, which was always the most frustrating part to me, that the police are there to protect the community members, yet we're protecting these people coming from out of town and often across state lines to menace their community, and yet the police would let them come in, often protect them, as they came in and went out and left again, basically viewing their own constituents as their enemy, the people they're sworn to protect. It unfortunately has a deep history in the United States of this happening, because there has long been an affinity for white supremacists and far-right militant groups within law enforcement. And that affinity has been documented over the course of years. Of course, you know, the origin of policing in the United States as coming out of the slave patrols, but all through Jim Crow. Of course, when there were racist laws on the books, it was up to law enforcement to enforce those laws. So even once the civil rights movement happened, we saw sundown towns all across the country where people of color were not allowed to stay in a particular community after dark. And again, those unwritten rules were enforced by law enforcement. So there's been a long history of this affinity, and unfortunately, we tend to turn a blind eye to it. And you know, the only positive thing that happened during the first Trump administration in this regard is that it became much more visible. But unfortunately, even though you did have openly violent groups traveling across state lines, which is usually the type of thing that draws federal law enforcement attention from the FBI, they also did not did not react and didn't begin policing these groups until after January 6th attack on the Capitol in 2021.
Can you give us a rough sense of the statistics of violent acts by the right and to what degree these numbers are tracked by the government, by the Justice Department and other entities?
So the simple answer to your question is I can't give you statistics because there's no official record of white supremacist attacks or even the number of fatalities that result from them. The federal government doesn't collect them despite federal laws requiring them to do so. They instead turn to state and local law enforcement and try to defer the responsibility to state and local law enforcement. But as we've discussed, there's long been an affinity and a reluctance to investigate white supremacist and far-right violence. So we don't have any numbers that you would consider objective or accurate. What we have in the vacuum that creates is a number of advocacy groups, academic groups, and other researchers who try to glean that information from police reports and from media reports. And unfortunately, what I've seen, I first was asked to go undercover in these groups in the early 1990s, so I've been looking at this issue for quite some time. And what I find is there are episodes that bring the far-right violence to public attention, either some horrible attack or some large arrest or some other event in our politics, presidential candidate making openly racist remarks that seem to appeal to these groups, that the media will turn its attention to far-right violence, and all of a sudden it looks like there's a huge increase or a rapid increase in these attacks. But it's really just measuring the media acknowledgement of these crimes. And in fact, these crimes are occurring all the time, and they're just not getting the kind of attention they get when something has thrown the spotlight on them. So typically I hear, journalists or law enforcement or researchers who will say, oh, there's been an increase or a decrease. And it's like, you're just measuring the increase or decrease in media attention and police attention. It's like shark attacks in Florida, where if somebody starts following them, it seems like they're increasing. But when you look over time, it's just a regular occurrence. So we really don't have a good idea of the entire scope of it. There's also some other problems with the way we define this kind of violence. But certainly there are consistent homicidal attacks year in and year out. And if you compare it to other groups that the FBI investigates in its domestic terrorism program, it's far more significant as a deadly threat than any other kind of terrorist threat in the United States.
And those other groups are what? Animal rights activists and groups that would be roughly put on the left?
Certainly those groups. The FBI has a very odd categorization within its domestic terrorism program. And in fact, the way it differentiates between international terrorism and domestic terrorism is very odd and afactual. The statutory definition of international and domestic terrorism, definitions of those two are simply the geography. If it occurs in the United States, it's domestic terrorism. If it occurs somewhere outside the United States, it's international terrorism. But the FBI divides its counterterrorist program in by ideology rather than by any objective measure like where the attack happened. So if there is a Muslim American kid from Kansas who's never left Kansas in his whole life, but engages in some kind of violent act, that would be considered international terrorist because the FBI views any, what they would call Muslim radicalism as a foreign influence, where if a neo-Nazi white kid from Canada came into the United States and committed a crime or even committed a crime in Canada, that would be considered domestic terrorism. And obviously, Nazis didn't start in the United States. This is also a foreign ideology. But it's just this bias that the FBI has. And it, the ridiculous nature of it came up when there was a racist anti-Muslim attack in New Zealand and another one in Norway, another white supremacist attack in Norway, and a congressperson was asking an FBI counterterrorism manager what you would call that, and he said, oh, at the FBI we call that international domestic terrorism, which is, of course, is ridiculous, but it just highlights that there's this differentiation. But as you say, then the domestic terrorism program is broken, again, further broken down by ideology. So there are groups that, and this was when I was working these cases back in the 1990s through 2017, they had categories for white supremacists, they had a category for what they called then black separatists, that in 2017 they changed to black identity extremism, extremists. They have categories for animal rights, environmental rights, anarchism, and then they broke far-right militants into their own category. But in 2019, they jumbled up all of their categories and kind of mixed them in a way that makes it even harder to differentiate what groups they're focused on in each program.
You said a few minutes ago that there is no tracking by the state of acts of violence by right-wing militants, and yet this is something that has been consistent throughout U.S. history. I wanted to ask you, though, if you have any sense, if you can have any sense, of whether there has been an uptick in violence since the first election of Donald Trump or the lead up to that. Is there any way to know?
What I would say is that we saw significantly more public violence. When I was undercover in these groups in the 1990s, they knew they were committing crimes. They were engaged in firearms crimes. They were engaged in conspiracies to commit terrorist acts. So they knew that law enforcement was probably interested in what they'd be doing. So they took measures to stay out of the public eye for the most part, and you know, tried to hide the nature of their activities. And what changed when Donald Trump became a candidate is that these groups came out from the shadows and started committing more public acts of violence, which created a bigger problem, particularly once it became very clear that law enforcement wasn't going to inhibit their activities or arrest them. So that has a couple of features. You know, if you look at how far-right fascist governments have taken over, it's through this mechanism of street violence. And the street violence creates public fear, and oftentimes that leads to the public demanding new law enforcement powers, which of course then the authorities don't use them in a way to protect the community, but rather to target their political opposition. So that's what we started seeing. And, you know, especially when the Trump administration and many of its supporters in Congress started this drumbeat that anti-fascists were actually the domestic terrorism threat. I thought, wow, that's pretty self-defeating, because if your opponent is an anti-fascist, you're pretty much defining yourself as a fascist. But unfortunately, the way the media carried that story, they lent credence to it rather than challenging it and you know, getting back to the underlying violence and saying, let's track the violence, because then you would clearly see that it's these far-right groups that are far more prevalent in committing fatal acts, but also are the ones instigating these acts, right? That there's a long history of these fascist governments taking power through this use of street fighting, and then adopting those street fighters as a quasi-state security apparatus. So I think that's what we're seeing now.
I'm speaking with Michael German. He's the author of Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. He's a former FBI agent who worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you said earlier that when a violent act happens by a far-right group, the Justice Department doesn't track it, doesn't investigate it, but defers it to the state and local level. Describe what happens at that point.
So there are a couple of routes that these crimes take. If you look, you know, and again, this was part of what we saw during the Trump administration, where, and even a little bit before that, where all of a sudden you saw the FBI and former Justice Department officials claiming that the reason that the FBI and Justice Department were deficient in investigating and prosecuting far-right violence was because they didn't have any laws. You may have heard this, that you know there isn't a domestic terrorism law, which is false, plainly false. And I couldn't understand again why the media picked it up and ran with it. And this is still continuing to be repeated when there's an entire chapter in the U.S. criminal code called terrorism. And I've sent that portion of the code. There's 57 laws in the terrorism chapter of the federal code book. So if you look at the very first domestic terrorism law in the United States, this was in the 1870s, the Ku Klux Klan Act, which was designed to give the federal government power to suppress the post-civil rights Ku Klux Klan, and was very effective. Well, the Supreme Court chipped away at that law over the years, over the decades, but it still exists as part of our civil rights law, what we today call hate crimes. And the Justice Department had this hate crime statute for a long time, but wasn't using it very effectively. So in the 1990s, Congress said to the Justice Department, hey, you know, we need to know what's happening in this area. And they created a law called the Hate Crime Statistics Act that requires the Justice Department to collect national data about hate crimes. But the Justice Department policy is to defer hate crimes to state and local law enforcement and then voluntarily ask them to report these crimes. But, you know, again, we have this affinity and this reluctance to acknowledge white supremacist violence. So most places, most communities, police departments don't report hate crimes. And this had been a problem for decades. So in 2000, they did a study to find out what it was, and it was pretty obvious. It's the communities that white supremacists and other racists tend to attack in a hate crime are the types of communities that police are already over-policing as suspects and underserving when they're crime victims. So these communities have a fraught relationship with law enforcement and often don't report to them. And then the police, because they look at these communities as suspects, not as victims, tend not to acknowledge those crimes. But as I point out in the book, there's actually a more benign explanation for it. It's a voluntary process. So if you're the mayor of a mid-sized city that's competing with other mid-sized cities for an international conglomerate to build a facility in your area so your residents can be employed, and your police chief comes in and says, hey, we have a record number of hate crimes this year, we can report to the federal government, and you know that those two cities you're competing against never report any hate crimes, you don't want to make it seem like you have a racist community, so of course you're going to want to inhibit that kind of reporting. So it's really the responsibility of the federal government, but they simply have chosen not to do it, even though we know that the system they created to comply with this law has been ineffective and remains ineffective. And as these crimes were no longer called hate crimes, but referred to as domestic terrorism, Congress passed a law in 2019 that required the FBI to quantify the number of domestic terrorist attacks by its different ideological categories, the number of fatalities that result, number of investigations, indictments, and convictions, so they could basically analyze how effectively the FBI is using its domestic terrorism resources. But the FBI reports, they state plainly, we don't collect domestic terrorism incident data. and the state and local police aren't required to report it, which is absurd, right? Terrorism isn't a state and local police issue, it's a federal government issue. And the FBI claims this is the number one priority, counterterrorism, and yet they don't collect data about who's committing terrorism or even who is dying as a result of terrorism in the United States. It's an absurd position to take, but I think it's part of this inertia in investigating white supremacist violence, so they don't want to acknowledge how deadly white supremacist violence is, so that they can still justify their investigations against animal rights or environmental groups that haven't killed anybody in the United States, and other groups that they choose to, not because they pose a deadly threat, but because they are proposing social changes that the FBI has a bias against.
Right. So what you're arguing here obviously implicates the state and actors within the state on all sorts of levels, right? The local level, the federal level. But I wanted to just focus for a moment on the police themselves. What do we know about the affinity for far-right ideas that members of law enforcement have?
Certainly, we have no comprehensive picture. And what frustrated me and got me writing about this much more regularly is that white supremacist affinity with law enforcement, or law enforcement affinity with white supremacy, has been a problem that's acknowledged in law enforcement and has been for decades, yet they don't have any kind of plan, any strategy to address the threat this poses to the public. And as an FBI agent, when I was going undercover in these groups, I was working on a joint terrorism task force that had officers from a number of state, local, and federal agencies. And we all received a warning that, hey, you know, there are people in law enforcement who have connections to these groups, so just be very careful in who you talk to about the case within law enforcement, within your various departments. And nobody thought that was an unusual or inappropriate warning to make. This warning was later documented in a 2006 intelligence report at the FBI that was circulated internally, but later was released to the public through a FOIA request that documenting the white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. And unfortunately, rather than, while it acknowledged that it was a problem, it suggested it was a problem for the FBI, that in the integrity of their investigations, and warned agents to protect their investigations rather than developing a strategy to protect the public. In 2015, within the FBI, again, an internal document that later leaked to the public, the FBI's counterterrorism guide warned agents investigating domestic terrorism investigations against white supremacists and far-right militants that the subjects of those investigations, so the subjects of terrorism investigations, would often have active links to law enforcement. And it advised them not to use the terrorist watch list, which is accessible by state and local law enforcement, in the same manner that they would use it in any other kind of terrorism case. So it's a serious enough problem that the FBI actually changes its procedures, but it doesn't have a national strategy to address these crimes and protect the public from the police who are affiliated with white supremacist groups.
Is there a way to sort of parse or know about the active involvement of police actually in white supremacist and far-right groups as members, such as the dozen members of law enforcement who traveled to Washington on January 6th to participate in the riot at the Capitol, and then more broadly, the attitudes of police who might not be involved actively in white supremacist groups, far-right groups, but who share an ideology that is similar to those groups?
So again, there's no official effort to document or address the law enforcement officers who have direct affiliation with white supremacist group. And typically the only way this is found out, and again, it's regularly found out, there are are academics like Rita B. Johnson at Georgetown, who have documented dozens and dozens of these cases in recent times. So it's known that there is a problem, but think of how absurd this is as a question that, okay, how will law enforcement know whether law enforcement officers are affiliated with these groups? These are officers they work with, right? These are people that you go to work with every day. And it's always odd to me when I talk to police leaders about this, because they'll say things like, oh, you know, we can't constantly monitor the social media activities of every officer. We can't, you know, get inside their heads and determine that whether they're harboring these racist views or associations. And I say, you don't have to do any of that. And I would recommend not doing any of that. All you have to do is ask your officers. They know who the racist cops are because they work with them every day, right? This is something that if anybody asks, they'll get the information. But right now, the problem is the way police agencies retaliate against whistleblowers. It's safer to engage in racist misconduct as an officer than it is to report another officer's racist misconduct. And that's what has to change. They have to strengthen whistleblower protections so that kind of retaliation can't happen. But it's also a leadership and a cultural change that if police leaders want to solve this problem, they need to go down to the officers and agents in law enforcement and say, we won't tolerate this. And if we find somebody is engaged in this kind of conduct, they're out. Misconduct, they're out. And if we find out that there are officers who knew about the misconduct and either assisted in covering it up or simply refused to report it, they're going to be out too. And we're going to protect and promote the officers who report this kind of misconduct, just as you would any other kind of misconduct, right? If we're talking about corruption or illegal violence by police officers or other kinds of crimes, obviously you want other people in law enforcement to address those crimes. So that, you know, it's not as big a problem as they pretend. And even if your police officers won't cooperate, go out and talk to the community, because the community knows who the racist police officers are, the ones who are engaging in racist misconduct. And, you know, unfortunately, when they make complaints to the police department's natural reaction is to protect the officer rather than to view this as an opportunity to get rid of a police officer who's doing harm in their community. So we don't have good records simply because the FBI and the Justice Department are not doing all they can to address the problem, and police agencies themselves are not doing all they can to address the problem.
Right, and of course raises the question of whether police agencies and those institutions actually really want to do something about these issues in the first place.
Exactly. And you look at a case like the police homicide of George Floyd. There you had an officer who had previously received complaints from the public about racism and violence. And yet that officer, not surprising, wasn't punished for those events. You know, that's common in law enforcement, that community complaints receive short shrift. But he was a police trainer. The other officers that were with him were his trainees. So, you know, here's an officer that you're getting these complaints about. Why would you promote him to be a trainer? It doesn't make any sense unless you see those attributes as helpful to law enforcement. And that's, again, the cultural change that has to take place so that we recognize that's the kind of conduct that we want to stop, not continue through the next generation of young police officers.
I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. We'll return with Michael German after this music break. Thank you. let's talk about one moment which seemed pivotal, at least in terms of the public profile of the far right. And that's the Unite the Right rally that took place in Charlottesville in 2017, in which the right displayed itself in a brazen way and led to violence and ultimately the death of one anti-fascist protester. What did the police know in advance about this gathering that was so high profile?
There were a couple of after-action reviews that were conducted that I think neither was as expansive as it needed to be, particularly in talking to the community about what had happened. So they mostly talked to the police about what happened. And what we saw, again, was a failure to acknowledge this history of neo-Nazi, Nazi, and fascist organizing, of using violent street demonstrations and street violence to organize. So they were looking at the event as a regular protest, even though many of the people involved, including people who were actually interacting with the police, had criminal records, right? These are people who are not unknown to the police. To law enforcement, but there was, you know, kind of the blinders put on that, oh, this is just people from outside of our community coming in for a demonstration and you know, ignoring the obvious and in many ways public intention to use violence against the community there in Charlottesville that these police officers were sworn to protect. So one of the after-action reviews highlighted that the police did not look up criminal histories. Now, the police were doing quite a bit of surveillance. They were monitoring social media of people coming to the event and at the event, and they had all kinds of cameras up. You may remember they had a police helicopter above, so they could see what happened. And the point is they had visibility on what was going on, but one of the internal reviews said was they didn't look at criminal histories. And when asked why they didn't look at the criminal histories, they said, well, you know, we thought that might be invading their privacy. So it shows such an odd view of the First Amendment that I can watch your protest activity and monitor your social media, but somehow your criminal history, which is a public record, is off limits. Kind of shows how the police create these justifications for not doing what they need to do to protect their community.
And you write in the aftermath of the Unite the Right rally that really the only serious investigation that followed was that into the death of Heather Hay, of the anti-fascist protester who was killed by a far-right driver. What signal do you think, just looking at patterns that you have seen, do fascist and far-right groups get when they commit violence in plain sight and there are a few repercussions?
So that's really the biggest problem, and one we're seeing repeated now, where when authority figures say positive things to these groups or rhetoric that appreciates or elevates their violence as helpful and necessary, that is a huge green light. And keep in mind, these groups, when I was undercover in the 1990s, you know, they're used to watching for dog whistle racism among mainstream politicians and trying to decipher how to interpret these things. So their ear is very attuned, even though they're not really part of mainstream politics. So that became an invitation during the first Trump administration. And it being able to go out in public, commit violence against their political opposition, and walk away, then attracted a much more violent element. And their ability to travel interstate to go to these protests and rallies and commit violence without interference by federal law enforcement allowed them to build networks and logistics that move fighters from one place to another. And that made them much more dangerous. And it's just also much more dangerous when these groups feel that they have some authority to commit this violence, but also that the police are hearing these same messages and know that, okay, there's no point in me trying to police these groups because the prosecutors won't follow through, because even if the prosecutors do follow through, they'll just get pardoned. There's no point in trying to stop this. And to the extent that I might be targeted for wanting to stop this, it's just not worth the risk to me. And unfortunately, we see that over and over again throughout history where the police just stand down. And of course, what we saw during the first Trump administration is many police officers didn't just stand down, but started wearing the militia group patches on their uniforms and bumper stickers and actually showing direct affinity with these groups. And again, that reinforces to throughout law enforcement, but also to the public. So if you're against white supremacy and you want to come out and protest its reemergence in public, you have to worry about, okay, well, you know, these violent groups can harm me, but also the police are going to harm me and treat me as if I'm the instigator of this violence rather than these groups that are coming in from out of town. So it tends to inhibit protest and try to divide the community in a way that's harmful to all of us. So it's very dangerous for our society that this kind of violence is allowed to happen.
I'm speaking with Michael German. He's the author of Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. He's a former FBI agent. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, of course, you are alluding to the January 6, 2021 right-wing mob riot at the U.S. Capitol, which Trump just pardoned everyone. What groups were involved, and how obvious was it that such an attack was being planned?
I'll take the second question first. It was very obvious. It was planned in public. In fact, it was preceded in Washington, D.C. by two earlier post-election rallies that resulted in violence. So the idea that particularly federal law enforcement tried to promote that, oh, we didn't have proper intelligence, is wrong. And in fact, you know, one thing I point out is in the book is that there was a local hotel in D.C., Hotel Harrington, where these groups had gathered during the earlier post-election rally that actually closed down rather than be a locus for this kind of violence again. And how is it possible that Hotel Harrington had a better idea of what was going to happen than the federal government? And unfortunately, that part of the January 6th Commission's investigation didn't proceed. Then my understanding from reports from staff members who were involved was that that was something that was demanded by the representative Liz Cheney to keep the focus of the investigation on Donald Trump rather than recognizing how federal law enforcement, really getting to the grit of how federal law enforcement failed so spectacularly.
Do we know what groups were also involved in organizing and executing the attack on the U.S. Capitol?
Sure. There were a multitude of groups and a multitude of individuals as well that weren't associated with the group. And I think that's one thing that's really misunderstood about the militant far-right movement, is that if you're not a member of a group, you're not part of it. But that's not really how it works. In fact, when I was working undercover and involved in the criminal activities of these groups, often I didn't join a particular group. But there were a multitude of groups, and obviously the ones that the federal government focused on were the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys that the government alleged had leadership roles in the attack. But there were a number of white supremacist groups, and they weren't hiding. They were flying their flags. And you know, duly reported, duly recorded by the journalists that were there. And this, I think, is another area where the nature of white supremacy in our society is something we don't want to acknowledge. And it's not just law enforcement. Obviously, there were current and former members of the military involved. There were state and local legislators involved. There were a cross-section of America. And but there is a hesitancy to acknowledge the white supremacy and the fact that these were groups that were attacking the Capitol arm in arm with open white supremacists. And yet, you know, often the media doesn't want to acknowledge that this attack was white supremacists. You know, it tends to be downplayed. And, you know, going back to when I was doing the undercover work in the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, Tim McVeigh and his co-conspirators were involved with white supremacist groups as well as militia groups. But the media at the time focused on the militia groups and kind of downplayed his connections to white supremacist groups. So today, when the historians are looking this up, they're of course looking at media articles and the way the government portrayed the attack and downplay the influence of white supremacists and organized white supremacy in this kind of violence. And I think it's really important as a society that we acknowledge that influence to understand how it becomes so powerful that it can disrupt our democracy.
Indeed. And I wanted to ask you, in thinking about the affinity and connection of law enforcement officials with the far right, so some of those people are, we would see as non-state actors, and some, of course, the police are actually part of the state. How do you understand the relationship of both in a moment where you have an openly reactionary president who seems to be speaking both to the organized far right, but also to the far right within the state? How do you understand that relationship and its consequences?
It's a really important part of the discussion that, you know, as we were talking earlier about the FBI's domestic terrorism program and how it considers these different ideologies and white supremacists, or what they would call a domestic terrorism category, or another euphemism they've used is violent extremists. And it equates them with animal rights and environmentalists and what it called black identity extremists, even though it's categorically different. Right, because of its association with political power, right? That this isn't some extreme group on the margins of society. There are members and affiliates and associates of these groups in law enforcement, in the military, in the prosecutor's offices, in the courts. It's a bigger part of our society that previous decades was dominant and lost that dominance somewhat during the civil rights era, but it's still prevalent, and we can see the disparities, the racial disparities that are created by all kinds of official government policies, and again by both parties. This isn't something that is unique to one party, not the other. It's part of our society. And, you know, when people in the military, leaders in the military or law enforcement talk about how do we address this problem, you know, every time they recruit from our society, because it's a prevalent part of our society, it brings more in. So it has to be, their efforts to address it have to be constant rather than episodic. But, you know, we have to understand it that way, because once this creates, you know, the people who adopt these ideologies have the levers of government power, they can do a lot more damage. And, you know, we're seeing that and our immigration policy, for example, has been openly racist from its inception, you know, with the Chinese Exclusion Act, you know, that it looks at Americanism as white Americanism, you know, and when it identifies who is American and who isn't, it's a coded racism. And, you know, when you look at the way Donald Trump and his administration are leveraging immigration concerns in a racist manner, that this is, you know, infecting the blood of Americans, and using those terms, again, that come straight out of previous fascist organizing in other places around the world. So that part of it, you know, we have to understand white supremacy is different from extremism. It's not extremism. It's far more mainstream than we want to acknowledge. And if we want to address it, we have to get to the root of it and understand that and address these racial disparities.
You've described the double standard that law enforcement and the state have had toward fascist, far-right, white supremacist groups and those organizing for social justice or identified with the left. And I think it's inevitable that we will see in the renewed Trump era more protests coming from anti-fascists and those on the left. I wonder if you could talk then with kind of an eye to the future of how you expect protests to play out, because you write in the book about how police consistently engage in tactics against social justice activists that are designed to escalate and lead to violence against the protesters. You mentioned the protests against police brutality in Portland, Oregon, as one example. But I wonder if you could talk about that dynamic, especially since whatever affinity police may have with a reactionary agenda looks like it's primed to be more visibly on display, or even more visibly on display under Trump.
The violent policing we saw at protests during the first Trump administration, and obviously had been a problem before that and since, it was very frustrating to me because, you know, I'm older and I grew up during the 1960s and remember those civil unrest during that period and the police response. And there were a lot of deep academic studies about what went wrong, and what they found was that the worst of the violence was usually caused by police, that the way the law enforcement reacted to a peaceful protest often drove those groups into violence. And so things like showing up in riot gear, things like, you know, using indiscriminate violence like tear gas were counterproductive to reducing violence. They actually instigated more violence and compelled people who were not violent to become violent because they were being attacked, so had to defend themselves from the police. So these studies were all done. They were known in the 1990s when I was in law enforcement and not forgotten. I think police know that this is true, but just cast aside because they, again, opposed the nature of the protest, and particularly in the post-George Floyd era, where you had protesters who were protesting police racism and violence, that they were protesting the police. So there was this kind of inclination that those people are the enemy, and unfortunately that's the way the police reacted, which is, you know, again, confounding, because here were groups protesting police violence and racism, and the police reacted by being more violent and racist. So it's entirely counterproductive. But one thing I do want to highlight is that when we look at January 6th as the culmination of that far-right organizing by the previous Trump administration, it was police officers who stood in the breach ultimately. And there are a lot of good police officers out there that want to address these issues, and we have to take measures to empower them and make sure that it's recognized that there are people in law enforcement who are there to protect not just the members of Congress that were under attack, but to protect our democracy. So it's essential to understand that they have an important role to play. But we have to change this nature. And, you know, I think one silver lining to the pardons of the January 6th people is you have police agencies and police organizations who and police officers who see the pardoning of people who attacked police officers as a questionable effort. And hopefully that will get them to acknowledge that these groups are not a friend to law enforcement, and in fact, often target law enforcement, particularly when law enforcement stands in their way. So they're not friendly to law enforcement. And if you're a law enforcement officer and somebody, a fellow law enforcement officer that is associating with these people, this person is a threat to you and to other law enforcement agencies officers in your department. And that's, I think, the most important thing for police to embrace, that, okay, this isn't just a threat to the public, this is a threat to us directly, and if we don't nip it in the bud, it's going to get much more dangerous and much more difficult to address.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Michael German, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michael German is the author of Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. He's a former FBI agent, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, and also the author of Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Our Democracy. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.